The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Time Magazine edition, dated January 26, 2026. The longevity issue is what the headline reads. Its front cover is bordered in red, as usual, with the narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in an off-white that blends with a bright blue, almost pastel, background. The New Old Age is in an illustrated format with the on top, new, next, old, age on the lower level. And it's kind of like a birthday cake because it's all spelled out. But there are four candles then protruding from the top layer of letters, which are T-H-E. All of these letters look like they're frosted in white and edged in pink with confetti dots in various colors throughout them. It says what to expect when you are expecting to live longer, and we'll begin with an age-related document here, and this is five resolutions that can help you age better this year, five of them, by Angela Haupt. This is a one-page article that should go fairly quickly. Five. All right, this is the first one. Let me count and see that they have all five here. One, two, three, four, five. Yeah. Okay, this is not the first one. This is the intro. If you are aging, and who isn't, even small habits can have a profound impact on your current and future well-being. That's true whether you're 25 or 75. For the majority of us, genetics will explain about 20% of our aging, says Nathan Labrosseur, director of Mayo Clinic's Robert and Arlene Kogod Center on Aging. Think about your trajectory of aging and how you can influence it starting as early as possible. Can make a difference in your year ahead regardless of your age. Choices in key arenas can determine whether you're thriving or merely surviving as you get older. As you think about what kind of resolutions you want to set for better aging, prioritize those that are both specific and measurable. Labrosseur advises, simply pledging to be healthier will not get you very far. It's also smart to ease in rather than overhauling your routine overnight. We asked experts which New Year's resolutions they recommend setting for successful aging. Okay, now we're starting the five ideas for resolutions. Begin each day by listing what you're grateful for. Looking on the bright side is one of the best longevity practices. People who are optimistic have a good social life, a strong sense or purpose, and better health habits, and the opposite's also true, says Dr. Alan Rosansky, a cardiologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who studies how mindset influences health. Fortunately, it's never too late to start cultivating optimism. Start each day by listing 10 things you're grateful for, suggests Dr. Carrie Burnite, a geriatrician and author of the book Joy Span, that's one word, The Art and Science of Thriving in Life's Second Half. It enables you to see through those days, those things throughout the day. She says, you might even be thankful for getting older. Researchers have found that positive attitudes about aging can increase lifespan by up to 7.5 years, while also improving cognitive and physical health. Second, do resistance training 3 times a week. Muscles play a key role in longevity. They improve metabolic health, support mobility, even protect against a host of diseases. That's why Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, author of Forever Strong, A New Science-Based Strategy for Aging Well, coined the term muscle span to describe the length of time someone lives with healthy, strong, capable muscles. She urges people to engage in resistance training 3 days a week, which could mean using free weights, weight machines, resistance bands, or your own body weight. Aim for at least 15 reps of your chosen activity and make sure you are working at a level that requires you to really push yourself to finish the last one or two, Lyon advises. It does not have to be complicated and it does not have to be technically difficult, she says. Push-ups, planks, and squats are great moves to start with on your way to weights. Third, reach out to a friend once a week. Strong social connections can help people live longer in good health. It is important to be proactive about maintaining and strengthening these bonds, Burnite says. And to schedule get-togethers rather than waiting for your phone to buzz, she calls once a week the minimum for reaching out to a friend. Every human is lonely sometimes, and we can solve that problem together, Burnite says. It can be coffee, a walk, lunch, whatever, but we have to be proactive about it. Next, this is fourth. Cut down on processed food and meat. Diet is the number one risk factor for premature death, and research shows that a healthy Mediterranean diet in particular is linked to a lower risk of dying from any cause. If you currently subsist on potato chips and chicken wings, however, don't attempt to go cold turkey overnight. Dr. George Hinnall, founder of the Center for Successful Aging at MedStar Health, suggests resolving to eat processed food and meat 2 times a week instead of your usual 5, for example. Start there with just a small bite, he says. And finally, fifth, try one new thing a month. Novelty's good for your brain. It's linked with a reduced risk of cognitive decline. Every month, challenge yourself to come up with one new thing you have always wanted to try but have not gotten around to, whether you didn't have the time, the nerve, or the energy, then do it. Look for something you're curious about and that you can think about and talk about, something that will help you grow and continue to develop as a human, says Burnite, who's currently learning how to play the piano. Next article is from the editor, who is Sam Jacobs, editor-in-chief. Trump in the world. You would be forgiven for assuming there are few places less hospitable to President Donald Trump than Davos, Switzerland, home to the World Economic Forum's annual meeting, the subject of a special section in this issue. The president gained popularity based on his ability to present himself as a foil to those who frequent Davos, for his antagonism toward expertise and the global elite, his distaste for norms and consensus building, his pillorying of those who privilege causes like climate and international cooperation over economic self-interest. Yet Trump, whose inauguration took place during last year's meeting, is scheduled to appear in person this January for the first time since 2020. It's been a very active year for Trump beyond America's borders, and the annual meeting provides us with an opportunity to assess year one of the second Trump administration. Brian Bennett and Nick Popley write, though the president campaigned on America First, his actions abroad may have caused the biggest waves. American presidents regularly turn to foreign policy in their second term. unburdened by a future reckoning with voters and perhaps wary of the domestic forces that can grind down a leader's ambitions, they seek out the chance to leave a legacy outside the U.S. The American record in the past 12 months is mixed, but the results are being felt everywhere. To measure one consequence, Charlie Campbell traveled to Zambia to explore how Africa's balancing mineral markets and the drawdown of U.S. foreign aid. To the surprise of some, Trump has been an energetic actor on the world stage. The latest example, he began the new year by arresting the president of Venezuela and promising to run the Latin American country. Elsewhere in 2025, he helped weaken an Iranian regime that threatened its neighbors. In one of the two major conflicts that have dominated the world stage this decade, he architected a ceasefire with an eye toward ending major hostilities between Israel and Hamas. At the time of this writing, he's trying to copy this approach to solve another intractable conflict, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ironically, some of the very sort of behaviors that rub the traditional Davos crowd the wrong way made these achievements possible. Trump shows no sign of getting up from the global chessboard. One place he's been particularly involved is trade. In this issue, economist Robert Lawrence writes about why the president's tariffs have not yet tanked trade. And Neil Mahoney, an advisor at Stanford Institute for Economic Policy, writes about why people around the world are facing an affordability squeeze. The other key theme at Davos this year will, of course, be AI. Contributors to this issue, including Time owner and Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, attorney Amal Clooney, and investor Robert F. Smith, write about how and what they believe AI can deliver in 2026. Since 2018, we, meaning Time, have partnered with the World Economic Forum to create our special coverage of goings-on in Davos. Our hope is that it provides a useful guide for what the world faces in the year ahead. And that was slightly abbreviated. Now to the brief. A weight loss pill arrives by Ellis Park. The launch of a pill version of Wegovy marks a new phase in GLP-1 drugs. This is one page long. In the last week of December, while most of the U.S. was still in holiday mode, Novo Nordisk's plant in North Carolina was operating at full capacity. December 22, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved the company's oral version of Wegovy, making it the first of the popular GLP-1 medications to get the green light as a pill for weight loss. People who want to lose weight and are prescribed Wegovy now have the option of taking a tablet daily versus injecting themselves with the drug once a week. They are expected to lose about the same amount of weight with either version, 16 to 17% of their starting body weight. The plant, just outside Raleigh, is running around the clock to produce bottles of pills in four different doses, which have been available at retail stores and online pharmacies since the first week of January. Obesity has become a consumer-oriented disease, Novo Nordisk CEO Mike Dousdar tells Time. We are embracing that. The company's entire supply of the drug will be manufactured in North Carolina. Days before the launch of the Wegovy pill, Time visited the plant to watch the first pills being produced, bottled, and packaged for patients. The Wegovy pill starts with a fungus, specifically the same yeast used to make bread, called, here we go, it's long, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, But instead of fermenting sugars or grains to make bread rise, the yeast cells are genetically engineered at Novo Nordisk's facility in Clayton, North Carolina, to produce a protein that undergoes fermentation in several four-story tall tanks, then multiple purification steps over about a month to produce semaglutide. This compound mimics a human hormone that regulates appetite by working in the reward center of the brain. It can help people feel full and reduce feelings of hunger. After the fermentation and purification process, semaglutide forms a beige paste resembling pancake batter. In one of the few manual steps in the largely automated production, technicians scrape the paste from large funnels and freeze it at minus 20 centigrade, where it keeps for up to 5 years. In the final step, the paste is thawed and further purified into a liquid at a high temperature, which is then spray-dried into a fine white powder, similar to the way snowmaking machines turn hot water into snow. That powder is then pressed into Wegovy tablets. While this semaglutide pill is the first to treat obesity, it is not the first that Novo Nordisk has made. Its initial semaglutide pill, Rybelsus, was approved in 2019 to treat diabetes as an alternative to the company's Ozempic, which patients must inject weekly. Turning Ozempic into an oral pill required finding a way to protect the drug from the hostile environment of the stomach just long enough for it to be absorbed by the body. Still, the pill is generally not as effective as Ozempic. When diabetes patients noticed they were losing weight on semaglutide, Novo Nordisk and other companies began to study the compound and related ones for their potential effects on obesity. In 2021, the FDA approved Novo Nordisk's Wegovy to treat obesity, and developing the Wegovy pill became the next challenge. This time, the researchers created a proprietary fatty acid derivative to better navigate the difficult environment of the stomach. Once the tablet reaches the stomach, it creates temporary changes in the permeability of part of the stomach lining that stops enzymes from breaking down the drug, while giving semaglutide enough time to be absorbed. To maximize the pill's effectiveness, people should take it first thing in the morning on an empty stomach with up to half a glass of water, with no other drinks, food, or other medications for at least 30 minutes, so nothing will interfere with the pill's activity. The Wegovy pill has an early advantage in hitting pharmacies first, but competitor Eli Lilly, which makes Zepbound, is waiting for an FDA decision about its weight loss pill, another big word coming up, orforglipron. Both companies are eager to introduce their oral versions of weight loss drugs, since pills are generally less expensive to produce and more appealing than injections, and that should make them more affordable. The companies and the White House announced in November that the starter dose will cost $149 for a month's supply for people paying out of pocket or using federal insurance plans, with higher doses costing up to $299. People whose insurance plans cover Wegovy for weight loss will pay as little as $25 for a 30-day supply. Doustdar, who was appointed to lead Novo Nordisk last summer, as the company began losing market share in the GLP-1 space to Eli Lilly, sees the Wegovy pill as a coup for the company and a return to focusing on diabetes and obesity. This is a big disease area. We're talking about 2 billion people. And eventually, someone has to produce all the doses for them, he says. We're sitting in the right spot right now to do that, and still only touching a fraction of the people who are in need. That was, again, by Alice Park. 10 questions. Let's see if there really are 10. And this is by Sean Gregory. It's one page. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10. Whoops. I'm reading 11. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, 10. Here we go. Now, here is Chloe Kim, the American double Olympic gold medalist, on why she's going for a third in Italy, what she got out of therapy, and some new additions in her life. There is a photo here in black and white. It's somewhat, what do they call it, cropped? We don't see the entire person, but we see a smiling face that is practically smothered in clothing. So whatever Chloe Kim does, it's in the cold. She's adjusting a helmet on her head that has very large goggles, which apparently will then flip down over her face. And she has very fluffy or puffy mittens hanging from the sleeve of an also fairly puffy-looking snowsuit. Okay, what is the state? Again, this is in the question-answer format. What is the state of Chloe Kim these days? Answer, I have no complaints. I'm happier than ever. Question, why are you happier than ever? Answer, there's been a lot of fun new additions into my life. I got a horse a couple years ago. I got a pet snake. My dog is so spirited, even though she's 9, so I just feel like everyone in my life is doing well, so I have nothing to worry about. Question, what kind of horse is it? Answer, he's an Arabian, he's a chestnut, he's just such a cutie patootie. I rode him quite a bit when I first got him, but I got a pretty young horse, so he was a bit unpredictable. So when I got a bit closer to this season, I decided to not ride him as much, so nothing stupid happens. Question, and the snake? Answer, her name is Jelly Bean. She's a ball python. I never thought I'd get a snake, but I felt little Jelly Bean, and I was like, oh my gosh, I feel this connection with this snake, which is like the craziest thing ever. Question, after winning your second straight half pipe snowboarding gold medal at the 2022 Beijing Olympics, you took a season off to tend to your mental health. What was difficult for you about that time? Answer, Beijing was just challenging in itself. It was during COVID. It was not like the most ideal circumstances. Family could not be there. Friends could not be there. I spiraled into another depression. We're so focused on this one thing for such an extended period of time. When it's over, it's very strange. Question, you've mentioned previously that you did intensive therapy after Beijing. How did that help you get to a place where you are now happier than ever? Answer, there was just a lot that I was holding on to, so it was nice to kind of let it out. You kind of have to go back to the root of all the things. The reason why I wanted to go to therapy initially was because I did not necessarily like the person I was becoming. I did not like the way I started treating people, the way I viewed some of my relationships. I just felt a little ashamed of who I'd become. That's such a terrible feeling, especially when I should feel like I've been on top of the world. Question, do you feel more aches now than you did at your first games in 2018? Answer, I feel pain now. When I was 17, I would take the most disgusting fall and be totally fine and just do it again. But now it's like, oh man, I don't think my shoulder was at a good angle for it to hit that way, and my ribs are sore. I feel like I got hit by a truck. Question, you've accomplished so much in your sport. What keeps you coming back? Answer, there's so much more I want to do. Last season, I landed a double cork for the first time in competition. That was a trick that I never thought I'd be able to do. I thought I had completely maxed out. Turns out I didn't. I keep surprising myself. Question, in late November, you and your boyfriend, Cleveland Browns defensive end, Miles Garrett, shared a kiss in front of the cameras before a game, confirming the relationship. Had you planned on going public that day, or did it just sort of happen? Answer, I did not think that was going to happen. I think it was a really sweet thing. No one's mad about it, which is a good start. I don't think we were trying super hard to keep it private, but it wasn't something we wanted to blast publicly. Now that it's out, it is whatever. Nothing's going to change. We're very happy. We're just going to keep supporting each other. And finally, question, any new tricks we can expect from you at the Milano Cortina Olympics? Answer, I do have a couple new tricks up my sleeve that I won't be sharing. That's never going to change, so you'll have to tune in to see them. And again, the subject of this question and answer format is Chloe Kim, and it was written by Sean Gregory. From the View, Nation, A Deadlier January 6th by Douglas Letter. Letter is chief legal officer at Brady United, the anti-gun violence advocacy group, and former general counsel of the U.S. House of Representatives. January 6, 2021, I was in the chamber of the U.S. House of Representatives as violent insurrectionists attacked, bent on interrupting Congress in its constitutional responsibilities and on doing harm to Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and members of Congress. Reflecting on that dark day, I keep returning to an underlying force fueling the violence. Second Amendment extremism. The movement I call Second Amendment extremism comes from what legal scholars describe as the insurrectionist interpretation of the Second Amendment. This seriously flawed reading holds. Americans have a right under the Constitution, even an obligation, to take up arms against the government when they disagree with its direction. At the core of this extremism is the dangerous view that the founders viewed aggrieved citizens who attacked the government through armed violence as righteous patriots rather than as enemies of the state. This perspective is baseless. In 1794, President George Washington used the army and state militias to crush the Whiskey Rebellion. The U.S. defeated the Confederacy over its attempt to destroy our nation through an armed rebellion designed to preserve the institution of human slavery. Yet, shockingly, this theory is increasingly embraced by many Americans today, including foot soldiers in the January 6th insurrection, and possibly some Supreme Court justices, and President Donald Trump himself. America's uniquely powerful gun industry has promoted armed vigilantism for decades, using rhetoric that encourages violence against democratic institutions in the name of freedom. In that context, the January 6th attack was not an isolated riot. It was fueled in part by gun industry marketing, intensified by America's dangerously lax gun laws and intertwined with an ever-growing white supremacist movement. A year into Trump's second administration, it terrifies me to imagine what another insurrection could do to our democracy. Yet the administration has ratcheted up attacks on political opponents, even as we continue to witness the tragic consequences of political violence and dangerous rhetoric, including the assassination of Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, and the attack on State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. Not even the attacks directed at Trump himself or the assassination of Charlie Kirk have caused the current administration to take strong action to stop political violence. Just as chillingly, neither the increasing use of firearms in suicides among youth, veterans, and active duty troops, nor the ghastly toll of American children murdered in their schools, churches, and neighborhoods has caused the Trump administration to reconsider its gun-friendly policies. In fact, early in his second term, the president pardoned and restored gun rights to politically violent individuals, including January 6 insurrectionists. The administration has worked to gut the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, including slashing inspections of rogue gun dealers, diverted resources from gun crime to immigration enforcement, and repealed funding for programs proven to reduce firearm violence. In addition, the Trump Department of Justice has quietly created a new Second Amendment section charged with investigating and rolling back local gun laws. One of its first actions, made 2 weeks before the fifth anniversary of the January 6 insurrection, was to challenge the District of Columbia's ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines disproportionately used in mass shootings and killings of law enforcement. And by the dictate of the U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, federal prosecutors have stopped pursuing felony charges for the open carry of long guns and high-capacity magazines in the district. Together, these actions weaken the systems designed to have gun dealers follow the law and keep guns out of dangerous hands. Moreover, if the events of January 6 were to occur today, I feel they would be deadlier. The district's strong gun laws, including its bans on semi-automatic weapons and open carry, likely stopped some rioters from arming themselves and inflicting mass casualties. Police made many gun arrests from January 5 to January 7, and insurrectionists left weapons behind in Virginia because they were illegal in D.C. Now, however, the current lack of enforcement of the district's gun safety laws threatened to make even more dangerous the kind of insurrection I survived 5 years ago. Douglas Letter wrote that article. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. Donald Trump's strike on Venezuela and the arrest of President Nicolas Maduro and his wife by U.S. special forces shocked governments around the world. Observers in the U.S., Europe, China, Russia, and elsewhere are left to wonder what Trump's bold use of force might mean for other countries, Colombia, Cuba, Iran, even Mexico and Denmark, read Greenland. But what about Venezuela itself? What do the strikes, arrests, and trial of Venezuela's president mean for that country's future? First, the good news, at least for those who fear Maduro's capture, will create a power vacuum that can be filled only with violence. The apparent ease with which U.S. soldiers found and arrested Maduro reflects an inside job, one coordinated in advance between the Trump administration and Venezuela's military. It matters that Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, was quickly sworn into power with the backing of the country's defense and interior ministers, a signal of continuity that Washington has accepted. Rodriguez has shaken a defiant fist at the U.S. attack, saying she was pained by the kidnapping of Maduro and his wife. But Trump's clear willingness to use force and the need to stabilize her government, in part by removing the current U.S. oil blockade of Venezuela, will force a pragmatic approach. Trump insisted January 3 that the U.S. will run Venezuela for now and refuse to rule out American boots on the ground. That's less a likelihood than a pressure tactic. The U.S. president has not demanded that an opposition-led government take power, waving off questions about Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, whose exact whereabouts are unknown, and whom he has called a very nice woman, who doesn't have the respect within the country. For now, Trump appears to trust a military-backed government that needs his support more than an opposition movement with ideas of its own for Venezuela's future. Nor does Trump want to involve the U.S. in the kind of nation-building project that a complete transfer of power would demand, or that the American public is likely wary of after two decades of chaotic interventions in the Middle East. All of this suggests that, though the situation remains fluid, Trump and Rodriguez can help Venezuela avoid a surge of dangerous chaos. Then comes the hard part. Though Trump's in no hurry to push for true regime change in Venezuela, it won't be long before pressure begins to grow inside and outside Venezuela for new elections. Making sure they happen will be a priority for Secretary of State Marco Rubio, other members of Trump's cabinet, and both Republicans and Democrats in Congress. This will also be a key concern for governments in Europe, which will be crucial players in helping Venezuela with financial support, including from the International Monetary Fund. Demands for free and fair elections will, of course, also come from Venezuela's opposition and its supporters, both inside and outside the country. New elections would likely take a year to organize. Only hardball negotiations between the Trump administration and Venezuela's remaining military and security power players can clear a path for them. But any sort of power-sharing deal that undermines the opposition's ability to win as much power as voters allow will surely trigger protests and risks of violence. The Maduro regime's security forces have typically responded to anti-government protests with a closed fist, but a still fragile military-backed government will need a normalization of relations with the Trump administration that can restore flows of oil revenue and other forms of help. There are also, according to the UN, nearly 8 million people who fled Venezuela in recent years in search of a better life. Many of them already face pressure to return home, particularly from the Latin American and Caribbean countries that house the vast majority. More than 1 million have moved to the U.S., most of them with temporary protected status. In the coming months, all these people will become players in both the politics of their adopted countries and the future of Venezuela. Written by Ian Bremmer. Climate is Everything by Simone Shaw, reporter. The past year brought a number of blows for the climate fight, but there were also clean energy wins. In the first half of 2025, for the first time, solar and wind power outpaced coal as the leading source of electricity worldwide, a promising step toward reducing emissions. Globally, solar has become increasingly affordable and accessible, encouraging adoption around the world. Pakistan stands out, for 25% of utility electricity generated from solar as of June, well above the global average. Solar's appeared on every roof, everywhere. It's on large luxury villas and smaller, poorer residences. It's on factories and government buildings, hospitals and universities, says Dave Jones, chief analyst at Ember, a global energy think tank. Solar power also became the EU's largest source of electricity for the first time in June. Some Central European countries saw solar generation grow at a rate twice the EU average, and China added twice as much solar capacity in 2025 as did the rest of the world combined, and likely peaked in coal generation, says Jones. Renewable energy even saw growth in the U.S., where homeowners rushed to install solar panels after the Trump administration announced that a Biden tax credit would end December 31. Solar and wind accounted for 88% of new U.S. electrical generating capacity in the first 8 months of 2025, per the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Even with the president boosting fossil fuels, in the U.S., as in the rest of the world, renewable energy is becoming too good to ignore. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. The previous article was written by Simone Shaw. Okay, here's Elliott's brief. Donald Trump ran for president three times, pledging to avoid the type of military entanglements that unfolded January 3. The capture of Venezuela's leader and his wife was a dramatic break from what many in Trump's MAGA coalition had imagined when they rallied a decade ago behind an isolationist America First agenda. Trump's core supporters once helped upend a half century of Republican hawkish instincts and viewed regime change as a discredited relic of a bygone era. Now Trump, facing an oil-rich nation he might essentially control as a viceroy, may see nothing but upside. "We're going to be running it," he said. He adopted a colonial posture, taking the spoils of war, as the U.S. did not do in Iraq, much to Trump's dismay. In a way, it was the first unfurling of a new American empire. "We're going to have our very large United States oil companies, the biggest anywhere in the world, go in," Trump said. Trump's rise to power was fueled by vows to end forever wars and limit U.S. involvement in other nations' affairs. On the campaign trail, he promised Russia's invasion of Ukraine would end on day one, and he would bring a swift end to the war in Gaza. But his rhetoric has not always aligned with reality. If anything, the first days of 2026 felt like a throwback to an earlier era of U.S. interventions, from Panama to the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, whose outcomes proved far messier than their architects anticipated. The initial reaction from Congress was muted, though it was hard to ignore the potential rancor. "This is what many in MAGA thought they voted to end," said Marjorie Taylor Greene, a one-time Trump loyalist. "Boy, were we wrong." In an hour-long news conference explaining the strike to the American people, Trump suggested more adventures may be in the offing. He called out the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, who had condemned the operation. "He's making cocaine. They're sending it into the United States," Trump said. "So he does have to watch his ass." Similar warnings went out to the leaders of Cuba and Mexico. Regime change, it seemed, has reached its ripe moment in this hemisphere, cycling back to a Cold War era. Ethos of American might is right. That was written by Philip Elliott. Next, the View essay, Sports, How America Fell in Love with the Beautiful Game by Andres Martinez, who is author of the forthcoming The Great Game, A Tale of Two Footballs and America's Quest to Conquer Global Sport. Back in the 1980s, around when I first moved to the U.S. from Mexico, Republican Congressman Jack Kemp, then one of conservatism's brightest stars who had quarterbacked the Buffalo Bills before going into politics, declared America's brand of football stood for democracy and capitalism, unlike that dodgy foreign football, which was a European socialist plot to undermine our ways. The message was that, like socialism in the metric system, soccer should be resisted to preserve America. And Americans were doing an excellent job resisting. To move to the U.S. as a teenager in those years was like moving behind some sporting iron curtain. I found myself suddenly cut off from the shared global culture of the world's default sport in a country that insisted on playing its own games to reinforce its exceptionalism, and then proclaim their domestic league winners world champions. There was no soccer to be watched on American TV. Efforts to establish a vibrant domestic league had failed, and I had no schoolmates with whom to talk about Bayern Munich and Barcelona. Worse, when we had downtime, they'd pull out a frisbee instead of a soccer ball. How times have changed. Rec soccer is now a staple of American youth. We have vibrant men's and women's professional soccer leagues in the U.S. I can readily watch practically any other league on earth, and more American TV viewers watch the final of the 2022 FIFA Men's World Cup played in Qatar than that year's NBA Finals or World Series. This season, for the first time, a majority of English Premier League clubs are U.S.-owned. But perhaps the single most potent illustration of America's budding love affair with soccer is President Donald Trump's embrace of the 2026 Men's World Cup, which the U.S. will co-host with Mexico and Canada this coming summer. I can recall going to some of the 1994 World Cup, which helped to launch Major League Soccer, but the vibe then was of an externally imposed affair. Today, three protagonists deserve credit for boosting the sport in America: the women's game, immigrants, and the global imperative of major U.S. corporations to brand themselves through the one sport with truly global reach. It's well known how girls and women picked up soccer under Title IX and turned the U.S. into the global superpower of the women's game. After Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, and Brandi Chastain naturalized the sport, the object of Kemp's disdain became the realm of soccer moms, demographers shorthand for the most mainstream, suburban, white voters. Meanwhile, across the country, immigrants played a no less apparent role in spreading the game. And in an era of accelerating globalization, American multinationals were always going to need to align themselves with the global sport. Coca-Cola was one of FIFA's first corporate sponsors in the 1970s, and not because people in its home market cared much about the game. Electronic Arts had a huge hit on its hands when it created Madden, its NFL video game. But for a truly global success, it would need to create its FIFA game, since renamed EA Sports FC. Media giants with global ambitions also understand they need to be married to the global game. The case studies go on and on. The coming together of America's and international soccer's formidable soft power will reshape global sporting culture for decades to come. That essay was by Andres Martinez. next articles are from a section entitled by Time, World Economic Forum, A World in Transition. What comes next? The truth about AI. Why the agentic enterprise will define the next decade of the AI revolution, by Mark Benioff, who is Time's co-owner and Salesforce chair and CEO. In Hampshire and Thames Valley in southern England, a new kind of cop is on the beat, and it does not wear a uniform. Bobby, built on my company's Agent Force platform, is an autonomous system that handles non-emergency calls to the police. The thousands of routine questions each day that can overwhelm response centers and slow response times. Bobby, spelled B-O-B-B-I, now addresses many of these calls instantly, freeing human officers to focus on the critical emergencies that require, with lives hanging in the balance, the judgment, empathy, and on-the-ground experience that only humans can offer. Bobby reflects an important shift in how AI is showing up in the world. What makes the platform work is not just a large language model, LLM, like ChatGPT or Claude. It is the way AI is woven into existing law enforcement data, connected to the systems and applications police already rely on every day, and guided by people who set priorities and intervene when needed. That's what I call the agentic enterprise. AI, data, apps, and people, all working together as one unified system that turns intelligence into action. I've been part of many waves of technology through my career, from the cloud to mobile, social, and now AI. Each arrived with enormous excitement and sweeping assumptions. These assumptions, like the belief that social media would bring the world closer together, rarely played out the way people first imagined. True to form, with AI, we are now moving past the honeymoon phase of dazzling expectations and into real-world complexity. This is perhaps the most important and most misunderstood phase of every tech revolution. It is the moment when the deeper truths that will actually shape the next decade begin to emerge. I believe there are three such truths that every leader and organization needs to embrace to ensure this remarkable technology delivers on its potential. The first is that while LLMs are incredible achievements built through years of deep research and massive technical investment, they're also increasingly interchangeable infrastructure. History shows us that as technology matures, the market moves beyond the initial breakthrough into a continuous game of innovation leapfrog. The second truth is that what we build on top of the LLM, the trusted data and workflows that connect AI to the way we work and live, matters most. Trusted data bring context, truth, and greater understanding. Apps provide the workflows. AI agents tie it all together with speed, insight, and the ability to operate at a level of productivity and scale that no team could manage on its own. The final truth is the most important one. The role of humans. It's people who bring the creativity to see around corners, the values that guide decisions, the relationships that hold customers and teams together. That's why I believe deeply humans must stay at the center of the agentic enterprise, with AI working alongside us. AI should elevate humanity, not diminish it. Now, that column by Mark Benioff was abbreviated. And here's another one by Mark Benioff and Ed Russo. Let's see, Russo's chair of the White House Environmental Advisory Task Force, president and CEO of Florida Keys Environmental Coalition, and a board member of Reef Relief. This will probably be abbreviated also. Ending the era of megafires. In too many corners of the world, the summer skies now arrive with a sepia haze, telltale smoke that signals both burning forests and systems under strain. First responders rush into wildfires, knowing they may not return home. Families evacuate, homes and businesses are destroyed, air and water are contaminated. In the U.S. alone, wildfires now drive hundreds of billions of dollars in annual losses, while the destruction of biodiversity and forest health locks in a feedback loop that makes each fire more likely and often more destructive than the last. Yet perhaps the most surprising fact about wildfires is not how grave a crisis they have become, but how preventable so many of them are. We know where risks are higher. We know a great deal about what works: advanced satellites, AI-enhanced forecasts, autonomous drones, real-time data platforms allow us to detect fires far earlier and at much smaller scales than before, creating the opportunity to act during the critical early window when they can still be contained. The problem is that while risk and technology have fundamentally changed, the institutions, incentives, and operating models for wildfire management have not. The vast majority of resources still flow into emergency response and recovery. Meanwhile, the most effective defenses, including healthy forests and well-managed ecosystems, remain chronically underfunded, even though they are our first line of protection. Although extreme winds unquestionably worsened last year's Los Angeles fires, even relatively modest additional investments in areas such as local emergency communications and water infrastructure could have significantly reduced costs and disruption, as Times' Justin Moreland reported in a recent cover story. California's expanded fuel reduction efforts in recent years, but the fires underscore the importance of broad, sustained investment in prevention. That was abbreviated and was by Mark Benioff and Ed Russo. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.